At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing very well. We just went to our local farm stand. We got the first batch of Stamen apples, which are my favorite apples for this season. So that's put me in a good mood. You know, Eric, I was thinking that instead of opening the way we usually do, it would be appropriate for us to mark the passing of Vice President Dick Cheney. I knew him slightly, but you knew him a lot well. You worked for him directly. And there were a number of things that have been said about him since he passed, a lot of them not particularly kind, and I think in many ways not particularly accurate. So perhaps if you would just open up a bit talking about that, and then maybe we could also talk a bit about the recent elections.
Sure. Well, first, I did have the privilege of working for Vice President Cheney twice, first as a Assistant Deputy Undersecretary at the Pentagon for Soviet Affairs when he was Secretary of Defense, the 17th Secretary of Defense, and then subsequently when he was Vice President for several years. And then I worked with him when I was certainly as Ambassador to Turkey, but also when you and I were working together, Elliot, in the last few years of the Bush 43 administration when I was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. I've actually been struck by the fact that, for the most part, his passing has been greeted with, I would say, nicer comments than I would have anticipated. Certainly from former presidents Biden and Clinton, from Nancy Pelosi and others on the Democratic side of the ledger. I would note that. In a piece in the New York Times yesterday, Tom Daschle was quoted as saying most Democrats I know would give their eye teeth at this point to have Republicans like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney back in office. I will just limit myself today to just saying a couple of things. One, just on the personal side, I've worked for many people in Washington. Despite his, sort of the caricature of Cheney as Darth Vader, which he, with wonderful ironic detachment, warmly embraced, he was actually, adored by his staff. I mean, he was unfailingly courteous, even, at times when you were giving him bad news that he might not have wanted to receive. And I had to do that on several occasions and came out alive. He also had a wonderful, sort of self-deprecating sense of humor. I remember when he was Secretary of Defense traveling with him at one point, and he was talking about his sojourn in graduate school as a political science PhD student at the University of Wisconsin. And he got a very prestigious American Political Science Association fellowship to serve on Capitol Hill, which he did for Wisconsin Congressman Bill Steiger, conservative Republican from Wisconsin. I don't know that he actually had an advisor because I don't think he even got that far. He was a ABD. He completed almost all of his coursework, but never wrote his dissertation, unlike Mrs. Cheney, who did complete hers in English literature. But he said that. And I think it was the then chairman of the political science department, Bernard Cohen, who wrote a very long standing standard political science work on the press and foreign policy, that when he was arranging this APSA fellowship for Cheney, that he said, you know, this is going to, you know, ruin your career as a political scientist. And Cheney said he was right. You know, it did. he had another characteristic, which was he was very, very thoughtful and deeply intellectual. Actually, he was a prodigious, as you know, consumer of intelligence, and I think a particularly astute consumer of intelligence. And he believed intelligence, and this is, I think, where a lot of people misunderstand, you know, what he was doing in the run-up to the Gulf War. His view of intelligence was that the relationship between policymakers and intelligence analysts was similar to the one you've described in your book, Supreme Command, about the unequal dialogue between political leaders and military leaders in war. That intelligence needed to be interrogated by political leaders to get behind the assumptions that analysts have, sometimes embedded in their analysis, sometimes explicit, but many times implicit, to try to understand what the raw intelligence said, so that you weren't just sort of at the mercy of some analyst's, you know, judgment that maybe was wrong. So I think a lot of his visits out to Langley to talk to analysts was not an effort to pressure people into coming up with anything. I think most of the people who are in the room, if you ask them, I was there for many of those sessions, would not say that he was pressuring them, but they were actually quite flattered that he'd actually read their work and was able to engage them deeply on it. You know, I won't relitigate, you know, the Afghanistan and Iraq wars here. We don't have time. I think in the fullness of time, his role in this will be, I think, better understood. The final point I'll make is, you know, he there's been a lot of discussion about how what he did laid the groundwork for Trumpism because of his very expansive view of executive power and the unitary executive, et cetera. And it's true that based on his experiences as a chief of staff in the White House for Gerald Ford at age 34, a period after Watergate where you know, Congress was, you know, really kind of very actively engaged in the, you know, the struggle for power in foreign affairs that Edwin Corwin famously described as part of our constitutional framework, that the executive had given up, you know, more power than it should have in this area. But I think what's lost on people is this was a view about institutions and the balance between institutions. And he, as a, you know, former member of Congress, also understood, you know, Congress's oversight role. I mean, he played an important part of that as the ranking member on the House Select Committee to investigate Iran-Contra. It was not about aggregating personal power. And it was his respect for the Constitution, I think, that led him to recruit you and me into, you know, the effort that he and Liz Cheney made to get a letter of 10, the then 10 living secretaries of defense to inveigh against the potential use of military power to overturn the 2020 election, which I think, at least for some people, has, you know, mellowed their view of him a bit or modulated it a bit anyway. But he had, you know, a breadth of experience as a White House chief of staff, member of Congress, House Whip, Secretary of Defense, a major energy services company, international services company CEO, and then Vice President of the United States. I doubt we're going to see anybody with that kind of range of experience again in our lifetime.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you knew him far better than I did, obviously, but I knew him a little bit. And I think the things that strike me in retrospect is, first, just enormous integrity. And that, you know, that very much explains the very clear open break with Trump after January 6th, that letter. Secondly, a number of times I saw him, I thought, and this very much meshes with what you said about him as a consumer of intelligence, an extremely acute listener in a city where there aren't that many of those. And I think, both you and I, as we've grown older and more experienced, have learned that really being able to listen actively and carefully is an art, and it's not a universal art. And then the last thing I'll just say is loyalty downwards. A lot of people in Washington expect loyalty upwards. The rare ones give loyalty downwards, and I think that was Dick Cheney also. So he will be missed. He was a patriot. He was a statesman, and he deserves to be honored. Maybe we can move to the elections. I'll just give you my opening comments, which is, of course, it proves that I was right. So in the following sense, I've, as I think you know, both in writing and on this podcast, my line has been, Sir Isaac Newton may have been superseded in contemporary physics, but basically he had it right when it came to politics. So gravity still works more or less the way he described it. For each and every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And I think, you saw that, you saw that particularly in the extent to which both in New Jersey and Virginia, the Latino vote in particular clearly flipped. And it's not that hard to understand why when you see the excesses of what ICE has been up to. I think the second way, which I think I was right, and will be proven right, I hope, is that, this is going to begin to, this is part of the beginning of the Republican Party coming to terms with the fact that, Trump will only be around 3 years at most, that there's a future after Trump, and they will have to begin dealing with it. And I think, you're already beginning to see cracks of that already in some things that Ted Cruz has been doing, but, even people like Josh Hawley and others, or say, the way that Senator Wicker is going after the Department of Defense, and particularly Bridge Colby. So I think this, you're going to be seeing more and more of that. I am, as you well know, somewhat distraught at the election of Zoran Mamdani as mayor of New York. But on the other hand, I think the laws of political gravity are going to operate there too. So if indeed he attempts to pursue the program of the Democratic Socialists of America, that stuff will fail good and proper the way it always has in the past. Over to you.
Well, socialism in one country clearly didn't work. I don't think socialism in one city will either. I'm just going to limit myself to saying that, my wish is that your belief in Newtonian political physics, is, goes from your lips to God's ear. I'll just note that those of us in Virginia, we did our part. So, yeah.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
I want to turn to our special guest today because you and I, for the last couple of weeks, have been trying to throw a bit of a spotlight on the emergence of the neo-Nazi or Nazi-adjacent wing of the Republican Party, which is now appropriately, roiling what my son calls the German Heritage Foundation. We have a guest today who is the perfect person to help us understand the origins of all this, Laura Field, who is well known to Bulwark readers. She's a contributor to the Bulwark. She's a non-resident fellow in governance at the Brookings Institution and a fellow with the Illiberal Studies Program, and more important, the author of recent book, Furious Minds, Making of the MAGA New Right. Now, it may seem sort of oxymoronic to talk about the intellectual ecosystem of Trumpism, but luckily for all of us, Laura has read a lot of these writings so that we don't have to. So Laura, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you both so much for having me. It's very nice to be here.
So maybe we could start, you could talk a little bit about the Claremont Institute and its role. It seems to have played a central role in at least initiating the effort to create a kind of intellectual superstructure of Trumpism when Trump first appeared on the scene. Could you talk a little bit about Claremont and its role in kind of kicking all of this off?
You bet. So the book, just to give everybody a sense of it, it's trying to cover the whole movement of the intellectuals. So it's still just one slice of MAGA, but it's trying to do a, you know, relatively comprehensive overview of the coalescence of this movement from 2016 to 2024. And it moves pretty much chronologically and thematically through the different groups and different people and how they came together. And so I talk about the Claremont Institute towards the beginning. And that's kind of my way into it, because as you both know, the Claremont Institute is sort of the hotbed of what people call West Coast Straussianism. And I studied in conservative academic circles with Straussians, earned my PhD at the University of Texas with the East Coast Straussians or something like that. And so I had my eye on the Claremont Institute. I applied to graduate school at the Claremont Graduate School. So I've known about them for a long time. And then in 2016, Michael Anton wrote this famous essay, The Flight 93 Election. And that was the first real effort to put some intellectual meat onto Trumpism. And Anton, people have probably all heard of that essay by now, but it included an interesting definition of Trumpism, which was economic nationalism, secure borders, and America first foreign policy. And I think it's a really useful definition because it's very clear. And I think it's in clear contrast with the kind of old Reagan Buckley republicanism, which was, you know, fusionism was defined by more like liberal economics, or people might call it neoliberal economics, sort of free market, free trade. Social conservatism, which is still there, I think, in the current MAGA, right? That's still an important part of I call it a four-legged stool, which is Anton's three plus the social conservatism of Reagan. And then a kind of liberal internationalism or anti-communism was part of the old fusionist conservatism. And so Anton saw that Trump represented something really different, and he went with it. He not only articulated that definition, but then decided that's what he believed in too. And that became sort of an important first move towards an intellectual defense of Trump. Just to articulate it is valuable, because I think he was right about that. And he also saw the kind of paleoconservative dimensions of Trumpism, which we can get into. But the Claremont Institute, that's Anton. He's affiliated with the Claremont Institute. I think he's a senior fellow there. And the Claremont Institute has been around since 1979. It was inspired by Harry Jaffa, who, as you both know, wrote this wonderful book about Lincoln and the crisis of the House Divided, it was called, and it was about the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And Jaffa was a student of Leo Strauss. Leo Strauss is known, and so you can kind of get back into the genealogies here. I think that the Strauss angle is sometimes overstated, and I don't think that Strauss is, you know, and in any way directly responsible for MAGA. But there is a kind of, Jaffa's book was quite Straussian, and he did this really close reading of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And so Strauss is known for the recovery of the esoteric tradition in political philosophy, the rediscovery of that, and just this really careful mode of reading that untangled all of the different layers of thought. He's known for this juxtaposition between the ancients and the moderns. And an effort to revitalize ancient thought, which is more sort of normative, imbued with, you know, virtue ethics. And so Jaffa was very interested in all of that and really saw clearly some of the moral foundations that I think helped Lincoln steer the country through the crisis. Anyway, Jaffa is his own weird person, and he inspired. He also had a kind of fanatical bent, and so the people at the Claremont Institute have sort of, I think, inherited some of that extremism that we find in Jaffa. Just the kind of dogmatic fervor has always been sort of part of the Claremont mission. But the Claremont School in general is dedicated to promotion of the founding principles. And they do that in different ways, and they see themselves as the only arbiters of the founding principles. And so, I mean, I could go on about a little bit more, but I think with regards to what's going on now, they've been really at the vanguard. They've been called the nerve center of the MAGA New Right, and there's a kind of culture warrior aspect to it, and there's also a turn away, I think, from the declarationism of Lincoln and probably of Harry Jaffa towards something that's more nativist, more explicitly exclusive of other, of sort of plural, exclusive of other non-traditional Americans, as they might put it. They don't always use that kind of language, but so it's taken this paleo-conservative nativist turn, but there's still this inherent sort of jingoism and fanaticism about the founding.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's also a walking away from the individualistic nature of at least part of the American tradition, which is probably most embodied in the Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
As well. Just to clarify, both for our listeners, both Eric and I studied with Straussians of one kind or another. They were the East Coast. I was interested to hear you refer to studying in Texas with East Coast Straussians.
Yeah.
You usually don't think of Texas as the East Coast. And you know, frankly, what I took away from it is A, the close reading of texts, and B, taking the ideas in those texts seriously, which I think, you know, is what really was Leo Strauss's largest contribution. You know, the esoteric reading stuff, a lot of people got carried away with that. He had a point about certain kinds of people, including maybe somebody like Machiavelli, writing in a time where if you said the wrong things, you could get into really serious trouble. But then I think people did run with it. I guess my question to you about the Claremont types is, how do you think they ended up taking what strikes me as an illiberal turn? And when I say illiberal, I don't mean in the sense of politically progressive as the way we would think about it now, but really illiberal in the sense of endorsing certain kinds of, I would say, authoritarian behavior.
Let me just add one thing before you answer, Laura, because to Elliot's question, because one thing that I think all three of us know, but might be of interest to our viewers and listeners less, attuned to some of this stuff, is that although there's a bit of a debate between Carl Hess, who was Barry Goldwater's speechwriter, and Jaffa and his acolytes, it's widely believed that Jaffa at least inspired, if didn't write, the famous sentence in Barry Goldwater's 1964 acceptance speech at the Cow Palace in San Francisco, in which he said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice." And I think that it's of a piece, I think that sort of spirit is of a piece, I think, with Eliot's question. There.
Yeah, absolutely. That's important. So I think one thing that Jaffa thought was that the American Constitution was a sort of perfect synthesis of ancient modern thought. And so that it was served by and facilitated a kind of virtue and moral virtue in the citizenry. And a lot of people see the American founding as different, where it's think of it as more of a sort of liberal agreement, not so much bound up with virtue ethics or morality, but more just like a basic sort of level playing field for everybody, a procedural mechanism, a more standard sort of liberal democratic mechanism. But Jaffa saw it as this having this important virtue facilitating dimension. And that's part of what made him so attached to it. Another important thing to think about is they saw the American, they all have all embraced sort of the limited government frame, which I, you know, that's fine. That is part of the liberal democracy. But the Claremont people were not Jaffa so much as, but some of the people following him were very much on the foreground of sort of this language of the administrative state and the growth of the administrative state. So they've been very, very critical of the administrative state for several decades now. And so what you get, I think, by the time Trump comes around is a basic sense among the West Coast Straussians that the state of the country is in really real free fall and a kind of this kind of not only the growth of the administrative state, but also a kind of cultural decadence setting in. And so given that it's this declinist narrative, right, that everything's going so badly, you have someone like Charles Kessler writing this book, The Crisis of the Two Constitutions. That's in 2021, but it's, you know, borrowing from some of his prior writings and talking about how basically the old constitution is lost to us. We're in free fall. That's the general tenor of Anton's essay, right? That if we don't do something now, something dramatic, then it's the end of the American experiment. So that's the kind of logic of the radicalization. So they think that the fall is so great that it justifies basically a counter-revolution. And they talk about that in different ways, whether it's the Flight 93 or a new Caesarism or just Donald Trump and January 6th, right? Just they think that they need to maintain power. Anything's justified. They have this slogan, do you know what time it is, right? And if you're a true and blue Claremonter, then you know that the hour is late and it's time to just, you can do kind of whatever you need to do to maintain power. It's these exceptional times. We can talk maybe later about Carl Schmitt and how he fits into all of this. So that's how I think it happened psychologically, that the fall from the founding is so great that it justifies any kind of counter.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that strikes me as, if I may say, un-American about it. That is to say, you know, I've always felt that there's a kind of long-term optimism, which I tend to share, about the United States. And I think you see that in Lincoln as well. And it's, you know, part of the American character. And there's a, while I agree with some of their diagnosis of what's going on and their description of it, to then, it does seem to me they get really completely carried away in the way that you described, saying this, you know, it's all going to hell. And so there, I mean, part of the Flight 93 metaphor is, yeah, the plane may still crash because that's actually what happened, right? But, you know, you have to make this desperate effort in which you do dangerous things. And I have to say, I still don't understand how they got there. I mean, the issue of morality and virtue. Okay, that's not, again, there's nothing particularly new about that. Tocqueville says that's the kind of moral underpinnings of the Republic have helped keep the United States free. And I think Lincoln believed that too. But they take what seems to me to be reasonable ideas and then take them to dark places, which they don't have to do. I don't know if, you know, you shared that view, Eric.
Well, look, I do. I mean, part of it, at least with Michael Anton, if you read the Flight 93 essay, is, and many things he's written subsequently, including efforts to try and justify undoing the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship, has to do with his sense of the country losing its ethnic not to put too fine a point on it, you know, white, you know, character. So there's a, I think, an immigration and, you know, ethnic racial component to this. There's also, I mean, it also, I think, leads to the next subject I was hoping we could get Laura to talk about, which is this, you know, more far-reaching critique of liberalism that you get from people like Patrick Deneen, that basically liberalism has dissolved the bonds of, you know, community in the country. And it ties itself also to the sort of working class agenda that some of these people are looking for in terms of the political counter-revolution that Laura was just talking about. And it has a very Catholic dimension to it, too, that you see in the Catholic integralists, who are kind of not completely overlapping with post-liberalism, but, you know, certainly share, you know, there's a Venn diagram there somewhere, you know, with Adam Vermeule from the Harvard Law School. And there's a connection to J.D. Vance, who converts to Catholicism and clearly shares a number of these views, and spread through other groups as well, including these the kind of, you know, aristo populists that you talk about, Laura, but also the tech bros from Silicon Valley, like Peter Thiel, who are also connected to this. You talked about red Caesarism. There's this techno-monarchist element here. And could you talk about how all of that kind of fits into this?
Sure. So I think it's good to think about the whole movement as like a networked clusters, right, of different groups. There's some overlap. There are divergences. There are tensions and contradictions between the different groups, but they seem to be able to all get along when it comes to Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. And so Vance has his thumbs in all the different pots, or like he's all through the movement. He's spoken at several Claremont Institute big events, and has been honored by the Claremont Institute. But as you say, he's closest to and he's definitely friends with Thiel. Thiel helped pay for his Senate campaign and beyond. So Thiel's also in some of these Claremont Straussian circles and has been for decades, right? So there's all this overlap. For the post-liberals, which the post-liberals are the group that J.D. Vance is closest with. He's been mentored, I think, by Patrick Deneen. Patrick Deneen is a professor at the University of Notre Dame. And for example, Vance spoke at his book launch in 2023, I think, or 2022 for this latest book, Regime Change. So as you said, the post-liberals tend to be Catholics. They are, I think, genuinely concerned with Catholic social teaching. They, of all of the new right, they are the most sincerely concerned about issues of the working class and have an openness to leftist economics, even, you know, social programs, socialist programs and policies, labor. And they're sort of above the fray. They're the elite of the new right, in as I see it, and that gives them a kind of freedom from the donor class, I would say. You know, they've been a few of them have been a little more vocal about standing up to some of, you know, to Elon Musk in some. Sohrab Ahmari really is the one I'm thinking of, who more than Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeule or Gladden Papin, who are some of the other people in the post liberal camp, has really stood up to the hard right. And to some of the sort of the Elon Musk Doge tech side of things. So, but generally speaking, whereas the Claremont Institute people are sort of rah-rah about the American founding in complex ways that I think have turned into a kind of nativism, as you noted. The post-liberals, the Claremont people think that we've been in a situation of decay from that founding. The post-liberals tend to think that no, the American founding, as Patrick Deneen will say, it's the liberal founding, the liberalism itself was the problem, right? And so for Patrick Deneen, he looks at the world around us and he says, liberalism is the problem. He wrote a book in 2018 called Why Liberalism Failed. And it took off because I think he was able to identify one single cause that was the cause of all our dysfunction, and even explained Trump as the sort of strong man that grew up out of that. His critique is that liberal democracy, you know, starting in the early modernity with John Locke and the founding fathers and all of that, is based on an atomistic individualism and a kind of conquest of nature and this sort of this empowerment of the individual person above all else, to make their way and choose their way through life, and this sort of unbound freedom, and that necessarily destroys the social fabric, acts as a solvent on all our communities, all our associations, and leaves a real vacuum of authority that then gets filled by the state or by the strong man who then comes in. And so it's a very sort of moral argument as well, right? This is about moral decadence, about a failure to cultivate virtue. So there's a similarity there to the Claremont School. But the post liberals sort of all share that analysis of liberalism itself being the problem and sort of necessarily caving in on itself because of especially the emphasis on the individual. So that's Deneen's critique. And there's a pretty powerful cluster of thinkers working with him. Adrian Vermeule is writing about this from a legal perspective. And sort of if you think about Claremont wanting to destroy the administrative state, return to small government, and shrink things down, which I don't think they're entirely consistent about, by the way. But the post-liberals think of it differently. And Adrian Vermeule in particular has talked about basically taking the reins of government and using it towards conservative traditionalist ends. And I could talk about how he justifies that. He's written a book about called Common Good Constitutionalism, again, as opposed to liberalism, which emphasizes the individual. His way of understanding things is to seek the common good. He offers this contrast and never the two wain shall meet. Basically, it's one or the other. And so his jurisprudence is a sort of critique of originalism and of liberal progressive constitutionalism. And he basically wants to charge the Supreme Court, you know, allow them or any court to adjudicate based on their conception of what would be best and preferably according to his definition of what the common good is. So it's quite radical.
Sounds like legislating from the bench to me. I mean, which was not the conservatism I grew up under.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the thing that strikes me is I've always bristled a little bit in recent years about the way the word conservative is used to describe a lot of these people. They strike me as anything but conservative, which means, you know, the common sense meaning is preserving the good things that you have and being careful about how you manage change. But speaking of them, could you say a little bit about the National Conservatives, who are yet another sect in in all of this? I mean, it's, you know, the thing that's fascinating about the book, I think, is, you know, you describe there are just all these little sects, and we haven't yet gotten to the Bronze Age perverts. And the real wackos.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems here when we're speaking about conservatism is just that America was founded at this in this revolutionary moment, right? And it's a kind of new regime. And so someone like Adrian Vermeule is trying to pretend that that was also a common good seeking regime and something sort of far more traditional in a sort of traditional conservative, I think, kind of reactionary mode. So it's kind of, it does get very messy. I in some ways, the book's not especially theoretical because I was trying to just say, we're just going to take it as it comes, you know, with this language and not get too fussy. But I agree there's a real problem there. The National Conservatives are the organizing sort of umbrella group of activists. It's a pretty big tent. They are led by a man named Yoram Hazony, and they started organizing these conferences in 2019, the NatCon conferences.
The holidays are here, and that means it's the most wonderful time of the year to save with Rakuten. Use Rakuten to stack cash back at your favorite stores on top of holiday sales. That's savings on savings. With Rakuten, you can get cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. From toys for the kids, to kitchen gear for the person who loves to cook, to electronics for everyone. You can even save on something for yourself. Just shop the stores you love, and cashback is automatically added to your account. And you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cashback. It's truly a no-brainer. Join for free today and get a new member bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.
And, Yoram is a Israeli American, and it's kind of been the growth also of nationalism international. So some, you know, there's the, but his outlook is that healthy politics requires a pretty monolithic nation state, and but a world of different nation states, a diversity of nation states is the best system. And so he's against any kind of liberal internationalism. Soft power doesn't seem, you know, there's kind of an effort to prop up nationalism, sometimes with a bit of a, I mean, he's not an ethnic nationalist, certainly not explicitly, but it sort of can occasionally veer into that. And he's certainly opposed to the pluralism of the American history and reality. And so there's a kind of homogenizing angle there with the NatCons. And so that's the big umbrella group. A lot of people, especially in the early, well, actually, Patrick Deneen went back to that conference recently. So I was going to say originally it was everybody would come to these conferences from all the different camps. And then for a while, there was a bit of a schism with the post-liberals. And I think maybe now they're back in it together. So they've been the organizers. The final group that I identify is the hard right. And here I bundle up a bunch of different things. And that's where I bring in some of the tech bros, though Teal's, I guess, more in my NatCon category. But the tech bro stuff sort of surprised me. So just the extent of the Doge thing and Musk. So Teal's in the book. And Curtis Yarvin is I put Curtis Yarvin and some of these other characters in the hard right together, but they come from a sort of a real mishmash of backgrounds, and they use more dehumanizing rhetoric. Some of them are open fascists, and there's a lot of misogyny in that group. So I kind of just put them all in a couple chapters to make sure it's in there, because part of what's been going on with what I call the MAGA New Right as a whole is the breakdown of the boundaries between the far right and the mainstream, right? It's been quite intentional. It's been theorized. And we see that now at the Heritage Foundation, some of that boiling up and becoming a problem for them.
And not just with the Heritage Foundation, but you see it with the Telegram channel messages among the young Republicans. They were young Republicans, and many of them, middle-aged professionals, in fact, but
absolutely.
But you see the far right. You see the misogyny for sure in there, but then also the alarming growth of explicit anti-Semitism that shows up in a lot of these places with people like Bronze Age Pervert, who. I guess I didn't realize until I read your book that he actually, I knew he was Romanian, but I guess he's also Jewish by family heritage. But you mentioned very much at the outset, Carl Schmitt, the German legal analyst who was a Nazi Party member and whose theories in his book, The Concept of the Political, which says every polity must be based on us and them. You know, there has to be an enemy that you organize people around. He seems to be the, as I read your book, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he seemed to be the kind of red thread through all of this that tied all of this together. He was the one, as you know, you and Elliot both have said, there are these differences, contradictions, etc., but kind of a Schmittian, sense of us and them seems to run through all of this. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you're wrong. And I think that some of the people I write about are explicitly sort of pro-Schmitt. And so you have someone like Adrian Vermeule. That's where I get into Schmitt the most in the chapter on Vermeule, because like Schmitt, Vermeule is a legal scholar. I think there's a sort of similarities in their mode of thinking. They're both very lucid, right? If you read Carl Schmitt, it can be very compelling because his formulations are very, just very gripping and clear. And I think Vermeule has some of that, but also they have similar views of the administrative state. So Vermeule has been inspired by Schmitt in many different ways. I think the most important thing to know about Schmitt is, or maybe the most interesting, is he's got a very radical critique of liberalism, just like some of these other people do. But he is, he basically thinks liberalism is an abdication of real politics, right? Because it's constantly punting on the important existential questions. And the real questions in politics are existential ones, right? Between friends and enemies. And for him, you can't really, you're not really defending anything unless you're willing to die for it. You're not, unless it's this existential kind of clash, then it's not, then you're not serious. And so liberalism he saw as just this perpetual rule by committee that would never make a real decision, would never do anything meaningful, was hollow and just sort of lacked any kind of existential oomph, right? And I think I read Schmidt. Schmidt's always going through these waves of interest in academia. I read Schmidt and thought, wow, this is really like, there's something gripping about it. You can see how it can be very persuasive. And so all through the New Right, you do see, whether they're knowingly alluding to Schmidt or not, there's the friends, enemies. There's this stuff about, you know, Flight 93 is like a state of exception. Schmidt's also known for saying the ruler is the sovereign is the one who decides the state of the exception. So he's the one who's the true decision maker. There's this kind of decisionism in Schmidt. And so those, I think there's definitely an existential, so much of the New Right has this Schmidtian flavor and tenor, whether or not they're thinking about Schmidt directly. And I think many of them are thinking of Schmidt because we haven't quite gotten to this yet, but one of the things fueling the MAGA New Right, and again, I mean the intellectual sort of upper echelons or going down into the manosphere, but partly just the kind of the staffers in DC and the overall energy of the movement. Part of that is I think sort of the modern crisis of meaning, right? That everybody knows about. We've all experienced this in our lives a little bit, and liberalism has these kind of problems built in. There are the ones maybe Deneen identifies, but there are other vulnerabilities as well. And I think that liberalism's refusal to provide answers to people about how to live is one thing that these writers come in and say, "Oh, we've got some answers for you." And Carl Schmitt was like that. He wanted there to be some answers. He wanted people to make a decision about what mattered, and then to have a politics that expressed that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I see what you say about Schmitt, and I agree. Obviously, he has a considerable purchase. I can't help escape the feeling that he was a much more serious intellectual figure than these people are. Which made him more dangerous, particularly because he was linked to a politician and a political movement, which was infinitely more dangerous. Whereas, Eric will probably tell me I'm not taking it seriously enough, as I do find it hard to take these people seriously. I understand that they have certain influence in various indirect ways. I guess I'm also struck by the ways in which, they kind of smack into each other in a variety of ways. I have to say, I've been very interested in watching, like right now, the meltdown that you're having at Heritage over the Tucker Carlson interview with Nick Fuentes, which basically you have Tucker Carlson, who's been doing this now for a while, encouraging a certain kind of anti-Semitism or playing along with it. And that doesn't sit so well with, you know, a whole bunch of the other people in this movement, but I think there are other splits that are here, which make them less than a coherent movement. I mean, they have various degrees of influence, to be sure, and they have kind of seeped into the minds of quite a few young people. But I wonder how, at the end of writing this book and thinking about them, just how powerful do you think they really are? And how dangerous do you think they really are?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind, I mean, with someone like Carl Schmitt, historically, he was important for a while. His arguments, I think, were taken seriously and helped to justify the, the consolidation of power after Weimar. And then he's been called the crown jurist of the Third Reich. And I think that's probably an exaggeration because he didn't last in that context. They saw him as opportunistic, is my understanding of the history. And he wasn't lingering around. And a lot of other people did join, right? If we're talking about Germany, and I don't know how high caliber they were, or, you know, I don't think you necessarily get the best minds in the end in the halls of power. But I think that the movement I'm writing about, I agree with you. They're not, you know, I can get very frustrated reading some of these people. I can be impressed at times, and there's, you know, it goes back and forth. But that's also my experience with most of what I read, right? Like you. There's, you know, I'm deeply impressed by Plato. You two have some Straussian background. I mean, there's people who I would place very high, and these people, the people I write about in the book, aren't those people. But I think it's a real danger to underestimate, or assume that because they're not the thinkers we might, admire, that they're not really intelligent, that they don't have a huge amount of, you know, intellectual resources at their fingertips. And then they've just been so successful, right? I keep being surprised by them. I was surprised that they weathered January 6th. I was surprised that they were able to elevate Vance the way they did. I was surprised that they got the Project 2025. I mean, in the end, I think some of that really has played a role. Elon Musk, you know, got in there. The radicalism of it, I keep being shocked by. So You're totally right. I guess we can talk certainly about the schisms and the incoherence, but I guess my general take on that is, it doesn't have to be coherent. They can pick and once they're in power, they can pick and choose the different parts of this that they want to use. Trump doesn't care, right? And so and they continue to justify things that I'm sort of sympathetic, and also I think we have to be really careful with dismissing them too soon.
I guess I'm not dismissing them, but I guess on the other hand, one thing that strikes me is very few of them actually have any serious political experience or desire to have any serious political experience, or indeed just about any other real life experience. The tech bros obviously are an exception, but that's its own weird world. And so they end up advocating and doing things which blow right back in their faces. And you know, I think for me, the key example, which actually we talked about earlier, is, you know, this extensive use of ICE to track down all kinds of people who are not documented and arrest them, including sweeping up occasionally American citizens, in ways that are engendering a profound backlash that already has begun to bite them. Or, you know, these tolerating these movements, which are like clearly anti-Semitic, which really is going to rub a lot of people the wrong way. There'll be some people who like it, but there'll be plenty of other people who don't. And I could go on. I mean, like the Catholic integralists. Well, so they are extremely conservative Catholics. That makes them already a minority within the Catholic Church, and definitely within the American Catholic Church. And this isn't a Catholic country.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I completely agree with that. I just think that people have been caught off guard a little bit by the radicalism of this administration, and I am too. And I think that this helps to explain, right? This movement accounts, right? The rise of these intellectuals, these quite radical fringe people into the movement, and basically the capture of the GOP by these people. And by these institutions like the Heritage Foundation. I think that gives us a bit of an explanation. And I think you're totally right that it is far afield from what people have signed up for in the main. And I think it's far afield from what, you know, even mainstream Republican voters today like. And so part of the point of the book is to say, look at this, you know, this is not in keeping with the best of America's traditions. This is a lot of it's really radical and scary and should be taken seriously because, you know, people can do things to make people, you know, get in line and we'll see how far they try to take it.
You know, the one group you talk about that I think we haven't touched on, and we are running out of time, so I won't go into any detail about it, but is the Christian nationalists, not mm-hmm. so much the Catholic integralists, but the Protestant Christian nationalists who quite explicitly, as you and Jerome Kapolsky and others have documented, we had Paul Miller on talking about his book on Christian nationalism and Rush Dooney and some of these other precursors of it, clearly actually want to impose a theocracy in the United States. I mean, it's kind of the handmaid's tale, as a political program. And it is a little jarring when you read it, because it seems so at variance, to Eliot's earlier point, it's un-American. It's, at variance with the American tradition. They can try and make an argument that separation of church and state wasn't integral to the founding of this country. But they're pushing a rock up a hill from a historical point of view on that. But I guess to me, I mean, I find it incredibly ironic that a movement which has in part ridden to power critiquing, both conservative and liberal internationalism for pursuing wars of regime change abroad, who very explicitly have as their domestic political program regime change at home.
Yeah, I think that's again one of these massive contradictions that is, it's strange bedfellows in some respects. I think I have a chapter on the Christian nationalists in the conclusion, and I try to draw together some of the different ways in which Christianity plays into it. And there's so much going on in the country, and a lot of people have told the story about how the evangelical world, especially the New Apostolic Reformation, right, and the independent charismatic movements, how there's this whole vector of support for Trump that's quite far afield from the people I'm writing about, and very radical ideas about Trump being sort of this new Cyrus brought to unify people, and just very radical. But I think it kind of works in tandem, even if they're not in agreement with the people, the Claremonters or whatever. They can work in tandem to keep Trump in power. And again, they will argue that it's not regime change, because they'll use these arguments about the Christian founding to argue something else. I mean, I agree with you. Of course, it's a regime change. And it's, even if the founding had more Christian elements than ordinary liberals like to think, there's still, over the course of several hundred years, also been a transformation in the regime. And there's very little capacity on the new right to contend with that kind of historical change.
I think one of the things to point out is it's a society which is increasingly secular.
Yeah.
By just about any measure. So as Eric was saying, they're pushing a rock uphill. It also seems to me there are two other dimensions to this. One is there's always been a lot of this kind of thing in the United States from the get-go. And I think to some extent we were lulled into a false sense of security by the success of people like Bill Buckley and suppressing the Birchers and people like that. And also Eisenhower, by the way, in the Republican Party, taking it in a different direction. Reagan, you had a number of Republican leaders who were able to contain that. I think, Eric, you always like to quote George W. Bush saying that part of his job was to contain the crazies in the Republican Party. But I guess there's another side. Maybe I may be contradicting myself here. I don't know. To some extent, they are reacting to some real things. That is to say, some of the things, and I think I suspect I take a darker view of what's happened to American academe than you may. They are reacting to something real that they're seeing and feeling. And I think there is something to the idea that you've had an expansion of the authority of a state which isn't really under real political control. The reactions to it are completely disproportionate and in some cases kooky, but it's not as if this is coming out of nowhere. It is a reaction to something. And I suppose, again, maybe I'm just trying to explain to myself my own, not complacency, but belief that this will eventually sort itself out. I just think we're a country that kind of goes through these sort of slam bang alternations and ructions, and you know, that take us in all kinds of different directions. This is not a place marked by political continuity on the whole, and so maybe I'm more sanguine than I should be. I know, Eric, but, you know, we think
what
of ourselves
think,
gloom, gloom and doom. I'm just gloom. Eric is doom.
I'm doom. So, you know. Well, Laura, we're going to give you the last word. We're running out of time here, but having, you know, jumped into the pool at the deep end of this kind of intellectual ecosystem that has been created. And I would note, you know, we talked about the Heritage Foundation. There was another somewhat concerning article in the Washington Post this week about Chris Buskirk, who is, you know, the person behind American Greatness, which is a website that you talk about, as well as its sort of antecedent, the short-lived Journal of American Greatness, which kind of kicked off a lot of this activity. Again, it was sort of a group of Claremonters who were behind that. But what's your sense of, you know, what are lowercase liberals like the three of us, you know, meant to do? You know, what can we do to try and make sure that the, you know, happy ending that Eliot is, you know, believes is going to, you know, arrive actually, you know, comes to pass?
Don't make me give. No, I'm joking. I just want to say I'm pretty hopeful too, just constitutionally. So I can't untangle my own sort of personality from my hopefulness. But I do think that, I do think America's got a kind of resilience. I think the American people don't want to become ruled by Catholic integralists. And I think a lot of the stuff from the Claremont Institute and the NatCons and the stuff we see in these chats and all of this are way beyond the pale, and Americans are going to respond. And I'm so glad. I mean, like you said, the Latino vote seems to have shown us some of this. So I think I'm very hopeful too. And I will say, I do think it's a response to real problems. And one exciting thing about the time we're in is that it kind of shows us, even the new right kind of shows us that things are up for grabs. And I'm probably not as conservative as either of you, so I'm a little more comfortable maybe with some radical redirection. Not necessarily, I don't really have an answer for where we need to go, but I think some reimagining, some ambition, some new projects, and you know, getting new people to run is really exciting. And if it has to be the case, if it has happened such that the new right has shown us the way with some of this, and I'm not saying we fight fire with fire or anything, but just to have a certain kind of ambition, I think that's exciting. And I mean, for ordinary people, I think that the election hopefully was really, really energizing. And people can see that they can make a difference and to get out there and participate. And my hope is just that my book shows and illuminates some of the scariest stuff. But I don't think people, I think that that's partly a message of hope to say, this isn't what America needs to be. These people are not representing you.
See, Eric, I told you so.
Well, you know, you closed your book, Laura, with, you know, some recommendations for civic education. And I think all three of us agree on the importance of civic education and,
yeah,
in some degree, paying a little bit of a price today for the lack of it. Furious Minds certainly is a, you know, I think a helpful guide to kind of what lowercase, you know, small L liberals are up against. And so thank you very much for writing it. And thank you very much for what you continue to do on the Bulwark. I'll be looking forward to seeing you in its pages. And thanks for being with us on Shield of the Republic.
Thank you both very much.